you again an expression that we had in our passage last evening in 1 Peter chapter 4, particularly because some requested at the close of the meeting that we spend just a little longer time on this, and that the suggestions that there are at least six main reasons why this condition does exist amongst the saints today with biblical examples, that we should perhaps run over that. So let's read again the passage from 1 Peter chapter 4. And we read from verse 12 down to the close of the chapter. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. Now that is true. Oftentimes, even for us today, when fiery trials or difficulties or tests, problems, adversities come into our lives, we think this is very strange. Why should that happen to a Christian? Christians are supposed to be free from all difficulties, didn't you know? They're not supposed to have any more problems. I remember when I was saved, I was going to high school, and I figured that all you had to do now was ask the Lord to help you, and you'd get first-class honors in all your exams. All I had to learn, as we all have to learn, that all the Christian's problems aren't solved just because he is a Christian. To the contrary, he may expect problems and difficulties, and we see why. So he says, don't think it's something strange that's happening unto you when fiery trials beset you. But rejoice inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. If you be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. Let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Yet, if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. For the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely or with difficulty, that he's talking about the test, the trials, the problems. That's the content, as you can see, of the paragraph. If the righteous then, with all these difficulties, are saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator, who, in his sovereignty and in his benign and gracious purposes, never brings unnecessarily difficulties or trials or troubles into the life of any of his creatures. I think perhaps that's the reason why the title is used here, a faithful Creator, and not a personal Lord, for example. Because he's dealing with Christians, as you can see, if any man suffers a Christian, as he says in verse 16, and he's talking about trials that afflict Christians, and yet he uses the term a faithful Creator. So he expands it, he broadens it out, that we would understand that not only is the Lord gracious and kind to us, his people, the Lord is gracious and kind to all his creatures. And he never afflicts anyone unnecessarily without a distinct purpose and end and object in view, or nor does he allow any of his creatures to suffer that either. So as the Creator then, he oversees the experiences of all his creatures. I think sometimes we have erred in that we have said, this might be appropriate to suggest it now, in connection with the title of Creator, that God doesn't have an interest in or look after the affairs of those except his own people. But the affairs of others, the happenings of others, the experiences of others, that the Lord has no interest in that, and he doesn't answer the prayers of the unbeliever, the unsaved, those who are not his. I don't think we are justified in making a sweeping or comprehensive statement of that kind. I don't think it's true to say that God does not hear and does not answer the prayers of those who are not necessarily born of his Spirit. I think the very position of God as the Creator
And especially in the passage that we have in Acts chapter 17, when Paul was speaking to the Athenian philosophers and said, each of us, all of us, and you are very superstitious. You have a multiplicity of gods. You have numberless idols. But each of us lives in God. That's what he said, didn't he? And in him we live and move and have our being. So, that being so, when the apostle could say that to the philosophers, I'm sure that we are not justified in saying that God never hears the prayer or answers the prayer of those who are not his. Of course, we take it from that passage, that scripture in John chapter 9, where it says, we know that God hears not sinners. You know who said it, don't you? Well, it's a blind man said it. He'd been blind all his life, so why take your theology from a blind man? It's surprising how many people will pick up that verse in John chapter 9, spoken by the blind man, and build a whole system of theology on it. And they will assert and absolutely dictatorially state that it can't be anywhere, any other way, God hears not sinners. Well, remember the next time you quote that to somebody, remember it was a blind man said it. He'd been blind all his life, so I suggest you find somebody else for your quotation. And anyway, I don't think that the blind man's even talking about praying there. He's talking about a man working on behalf of God to perform miracles for the blessings of others. That's what he's talking about. And if any man be a worshiper of him, he says, him he hears, and to him he responds, and on his behalf he acts. So we must be careful of making statements like that. Now then, last evening then we closed on this expression here in verse 19 of chapter 4, suffering according to the will of God. And I would like to blow a hole, you know, a 100-ton, megaton bomb hole, through the theory that is postulated by a lot of people today that Christians shouldn't or don't ever suffer. That they should never have difficulties or get sick or have problems in their life at all. If they're walking with the Lord, then everything must go right. And they'll quote you that verse, if a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Quote to that verse. And they say, now, that means that if you're walking in the will of God, if you're walking to please the Lord, even your enemies will be your very best friends, or at least they'll be at peace with you. Therefore, how could you expect possibly for a Christian to have any difficulty? All right, just take this expression on the surface of it. Suffer according to the will of God. And I think that refutes that theory. And previously in verse 16, he said, suffer as a Christian. Well, then Christians must suffer, mustn't they? And the apostle says, all that will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. So Christians suffer one way and another, and for one reason or another, Christians suffer. Christians experience difficulties. Christians don't have all their finances just going the best way. Christians don't always find at the end of the year that they're going to get a $500 refund on their income tax. You know? Christians don't find out that in the assembly everything's going to be smooth, and in their family everything's going to be smooth, and in their emotional life and so on everything's going to be smooth. No. There is such a thing as suffering according to the will of God. All right. I suggested then to you last evening that there are at least three reasons, basic and main reasons, or six rather, I'm sorry, I must keep my mathematics straight. Six reasons why Christians suffer when they suffer according to the will of God. And I suggested to you that only one of the six that I was asked to mention and to deliberate a little on this evening is for punishment purposes. And the rest are not. And for that reason, we must not be hasty in concluding when something goes wrong with somebody. Well, we knew all the time it was going to happen to them because they hadn't been living right. They hadn't been walking before the Lord. They hadn't been taking Him into consideration. Therefore, not much wonder that their world fell apart. The first one I want to suggest to you then is that one of the first reasons why Christians suffer is for or with preparation. I'm going to use the word preparation. A preparatory experience of suffering. And I want to give you one of the best examples I know for that in the scriptures, and is well known to you all.
and that is the life of Joseph. And if you study the life of Joseph, you will find in the life of a young man, everything seemed to go wrong. Unnecessarily, unjustly, and unexpectedly. Joseph is an intriguing character because he is not astute, he's not sharp, he's not clever, he's not on his toes. He wouldn't be a very accomplished businessman today, I wouldn't think. In fact, he appeals to me as being a little naive. How else could you explain the fact that when he had a dream, and this dream indicated to him and to his brothers, when he dreamt about the stars, you remember, or the sheaves, rather, in the field, there was in the field and the sheaves, and the sheaves fell all down and bowed down to his sheaf. And they interpreted that, and he evidently had interpreted that too, that the Lord was indicating to him what was coming up in his life ahead, and that was he was going to rule over his brothers. And because he's the second youngest of the family, of course, they didn't like that not a little bit. And the more Joseph pondered it, I suppose, at least I'm assuming this much, at any rate, the more he was delighted with it. He was thrilled with it. He was so naive that he thought that what made him happy would make everybody happy. Now, some people have that experience when they first are saved, don't they? Go home and tell the whole family, and they're sure the whole family gets saved before supper. They discover it didn't work that way. Or you discover something in the Scriptures, and it really thrills you, it excites you, and you go and tell somebody, and you're sure they're going to be excited too, and they look at you with a long, glum face and say, what's going wrong with him? Doesn't he know that the gold is down $15 today? Dark market, going bad. You know, and they come across with a reaction like that, and then you say, what's all these people? All right. If you share your joys, if you share your thrills in the spiritual world with other people, you'll come across reactions like that. And Joseph was very naive, so he told his brethren just exactly what he had dreamed. And they said, you, who do you think you are? You're just our kid brother. Like Miriam and Aaron said about Moses later on. You're just our kid brother. You mean we are going to bow down to you? You mean you're going to be boss over us? And they hated him for it. Well, the reason I say he was naive, I don't know how else to explain it. At least in modern language, it seems to me that way. He had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the stars all bowed down to him. And they interpreted that the sun was his father and the moon was his mother and they were the stars, and they were all going to bow down to him. So they told the old man about it. And the old man wasn't at all pleased about it. Here's this boy of his having dreams like this. And now he's included his parents. Well, now that's an insult, and it goes totally against the social culture of the day. And why didn't he just keep it to himself and dream on, you know, and enjoy it? Instead of that, his father calls him to account and calls him to task about it, and he rebukes him for it and says, no, that's not right at all. You're getting very preposterous. You're getting very presumptuous. You're altogether out of your place. Your mother and I and your brethren bow down to you. So, things started to go wrong with Joseph when he thought they were headed for right. When everything looked bright and brilliant in front of him, that's just when everything started to get cloudy and dark. Watch it then when the Lord brings you into some place of blessing. When you do have some personal dealings with God, when you do get excited and thrilled about something the Lord reveals to you from His Word, or something happens in your family, or in your Sunday school class, or in the assembly, or whatever, watch out, because just as sure as that happens, you're going to have a counterbalance of some kind, and you're not going to like it. You're going to be surprised. Well, now you know the rest of the story. His brethren are way out there with the sheep and on the range, and his father wants to know how they're getting along, so he sends Joseph along, remember, with some food for them. And they see him coming, and they said, aha, the dreamer's coming. Let's get rid of him and see what happens to his dreams. So they catch him. You remember when he arrived there. And they're going to slay him, but one of his brother intercedes for him. He said, no, let's not shed his blood. Just throw him in the pit and let him die in the dried up well or whatever the pit was. And then we won't have his blood in our hands. Oh no, who would be responsible? Just drop him in there and let him die. And later on we read in the Psalms how he pleaded with them. And they wouldn't listen to him. They are so incensed against him. They actually hate him. Deep in their bones, they hate him.
because God had revealed something to him that was going to make them subservient to him. And then you remember what happened? The Ishmaelites came along the way, the caravan came down, and they said, hey, here's a chance to wipe it all out, wind it all up, and we won't be responsible for his death. And so they bring him up, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites, and it says, he begged with them, the iron entered into his soul, but they would pay no attention, and they sold him down into Egypt. So he's hurried away from home, and he's just a teenager, and he's sold as a slave. But it says the Lord was with him. You mean the Lord is with us when everything is against us? Yes. Yes. Suffering according to the will of God. When he gets down there, you remember what happens? The Ishmaelites just make merchandise out of him, so they resell him again, and he's turned over into the hands of one of Pharaoh's officers of the guard. And then, you know the story, how he finds favor, and things start to go up again. His world begins to expand again. Things look bright and rosy, until one day, his master's wife endeavored to seduce him, and he wouldn't be seduced, so she lied against him, and when her husband came home, she told him the story, and he threw him into prison, and now the whole world crumbles around him again. Thus far, you can find no reason for everything going wrong. You can't accuse him of anything except perhaps being a little naive. I don't know what else. But everything's going wrong. But he gets down in the prison, and God blesses him in the prison because the Lord knows his righteousness and his faith in what God had imparted to him. And so down in the prison, after a while, you remember the warden of the prison begins to put some of the prisoners in his charge, and his little world starts to blossom again. And he's expanding again. And everything's going pretty well right now. And one day he comes along to the cells where the butler and the baker were, who had been thrown into prison by Pharaoh, and you remember they said, they looked awful sad that morning. And when Joseph comes in, looking after them, he said, how come you're so sad looking? And they said, well, we both had a dream last night. And I don't know about you, but I think if I had been Joseph, I'd said, forget it. I had 11 years ago. Nothing ever came of it. Don't believe in dreams anymore. Ever since I had a dream, everything's gone wrong. So I suggest you keep it to yourself. Isn't that the way you'd react? I think I'd react that way. But this man has a buoyant spirit. About 28 years of age now. He has a very buoyant spirit. I guess they'd say ebullient in our day. You know, irrepressible. One of these fellows you just can't keep him under indefinitely. Somehow or another he has his confidence in God. And when everything's going against him and continues to go against him, somehow or another there's an inner force. There's a spring of life and buoyancy in his soul. And he is to be greatly commended for that. Because it's very easy to get down in the mouth and blue around the gills, isn't it? When things continue to go wrong with you. He said, tell me your dreams. There's an interpretation for dreams. So they told him his dreams, and one of them was going to be pardoned, released out of prison, restored to his former position, and the other one's going to be hanged. And sure enough, exactly as Joseph predicted, it happened. And before it happened, he said, now look, to the butler, he said, when everything goes well with you, he really believed, you see, that his interpretation was going to come true. God had given them the dream, and the dream would be fulfilled. Now that's a test of faith. Because when we get a promise from God, oftentimes we expect him, if he gives it to us today, to fulfill it tomorrow. Right? And like the little model says, Lord, give me patience, but make it quick. You know? When the Lord promises us something, when we get into a covenant relationship with God, or when he gets something out of his word, and we know it's true, we want the Lord now to fulfill it tomorrow. 11 years have gone by, and he has not fulfilled the dreams that he gave Joseph. And yet, Joseph sees their dreams get fulfilled. Now, do you know anything harder to do than play second fiddle to somebody? Come on, I'll be honest. Don't look too saintly. Just kind of look natural. Do you know anything harder to do than that? I think the man that wrote the last 5 books of our Bible had that test imposed upon him. He was one of the first that was called from the fishing nets. to walk with the Lord and to be an apostle. He was marked out amongst the very first. You remember what happened? His brother was slain with a sword before the thing even got rolling, hardly, after Pentecost. And then a little later, what happens? Saul of Tarsus gets saved, and he comes right out into the front, and he takes over the whole scenery, the whole stage. And where's John? I don't know where John is. And the years roll by, and the years roll by, and here's this man that comes behind him, gets all the prominence, and John's away off in the shadows someplace. I don't know where he is, or what he's doing. Playing second fiddle isn't easy for anyone. It's the master fiddler that gets the recognition at the concert and stands up and takes the bow, right? That's the first violin. Now then, later on, of course, the Lord picks up John and he used him to write the last five books of our Bible that fulfill and finish off the canon of Revelation being complementary to the first five books of our Bible. All right. Joseph sees their dream fulfilled. But before it happens, he says, now listen, when everything's going right with you, remember me. And he goes right back to home where he had the dream. He said, I was taken from my father's house unjustly, unfairly, and I was sold down into Egypt, and I have done nothing wrong. So speak to Pharaoh for me. You know what happened? It went wrong again. Because when the butler gets restored to his position, he forgot all about Joseph. Talk about an ungrateful world. You ever do a good kindness for somebody? And they didn't even write you a note of thanks. You ever do somebody and they never even said thank you? You do a favor for somebody like that and it really costs you something to do it and you say, what kind of stuff are they made of anyway? Who dragged them up? Don't even enough decency to be grateful. Mind you, one of the crowning sins of the Bible, let's not be guilty of it, the Lord charged the whole nation of Israel once with it, being ungrateful. Here's the butler and he's absolutely ungrateful. Never even thought of Joseph again. And two more years go by before it happens. What's all this suffering according to the will of God for? It's all a preparation. All a preparation. It's all a little schooling to get him ready for one giant test. Well, it was for mankind. It was for the world of Egypt anyway at that time. It wasn't on the moon, but anyway. He took one giant step out of the prison, right to the throne of Egypt. Or almost to the throne of Egypt, because Pharaoh said to him, you remember when Pharaoh had a dream then? My, but the Lord can work things out, can he though? If we just give him time. Well, you say, that's the problem. Listen, we have all the time there is. And the Lord never is in a hurry about anything anyway. Give him time. So the butler forgets his dream, the butler forgets all about Joseph, so God says, well, I'll have to do it through Pharaoh. So he gives Pharaoh the dream. And the very same medium, instrument, vehicle, or means by which the Lord promised Joseph his future in the first place is the very same thing that God used to set him right at the height of power in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh has a dream, and you remember he forgot the dream, and he called in the scholars and wise men, so on and so forth. Now, all this was with a view to the fact that God was going to take a prisoner out of the prison and set him in the place of vice regent, of controller, or comptroller, or secretary treasurer, or general administrator, or I don't know what you call him today, minister of internal affairs, I guess, of the whole land of Egypt. Was it worth it? It was 13 long years. 13, the number they don't put in the apartments anymore, you know? No 13th floor, no 13th floor, no 13th room in the apartment buildings anymore. It was 13 years from the time he was 17 till he was 30. But God was doing all this. And what was he doing? He was suffering according to the will of God. And it was all a preparation, my friends. Now you don't know, and I don't know, what God has in store for us. And I don't mean down here, I mean over there. And this whole life, I am convinced, the longer I live, don't get any ideas, I haven't lived very long yet. I am convinced that all of life is preparatory. It's all a preparation for the position that God has for us in the world to come. So if you haven't had any trouble, yes. Maybe you'll just be asked to give out the hymn books in the New Jerusalem choir.
Maybe there won't be a big administrative job waiting for you.
So, beloved, don't think it strange when the fiery trial comes along to try you. It may all be suffering according to the will of God by way of preparation.
I think
the 13 years are nothing more nor less than that.
You couldn't take it, and I couldn't take it. Take a man out of prison and set him in Pharaoh's chariot, and Pharaoh would say, only in the throne will I be greater than thou. Not a dog will wag its tongue against you. No happy.
Happy, where did I get the word from? I was going to say capataz, and then I went and said happy.
Well, no taskmaster, no foreman, no director, no government position will be over you. You will be chief of them all. That's what he said.
And God had to prepare him. You see, we don't have the kind of fiber in our moral being that could take that kind of thing without the preparation.
The next one,
that's preparation.
The next one that I want to suggest to you is probation. And one of the best examples that I know in connection with probation, you know what probation is, don't you? When they put a man out on probation, they're testing him, is the story of Job. And ever a man was hit with a fiery trial, Job was. None of us have had happen to him or her what happened to Job in one day. You talk about a hurricane. You talk about an earthquake. You talk about a volcanic explosion. It all happened in Job's experience. He lost all his wealth in one day, which is enough to turn many a man insane. And then he lost all his family, the next dreadful stroke that hit him. You know, he wasn't a father that just let his children run wild either. He had disciplined them. He even had sanctified them. He even had offered to the Lord his own prayers for forgiveness for them, and offered to the Lord sacrifices to atone for the sins that they might have committed that he didn't know about, but that he was apprehensive concerning. And that's the kind of father he was. And yet he lost all his 10 children in one day. And behind it all was Satan. It was Satan that sent the marauders against him, that robbed him of all his wealth. It was Satan that blew the bottom out of his financial empire. It was Satan that created the storm that gathered the elements together, that destroyed the house and killed his 10 children. And then they tell me, Satan can't hurt a Christian. I had someone tell me that just a couple of weeks ago. After me, they said, I think you suggested tonight that Satan could hurt a Christian. I said, did I? They said, yes, you did. And we don't believe that that's possible. Well, why don't you believe it's possible? Well, because a Christian has the Spirit of God dwelling in him. So, whose world are you living in? Whose kingdom are you living in? Whose territory is it? And all the examples that we have in the scriptures of Satan exercising influence over and working and warring against God's people are sufficient to stop that argument. Here's a case in point. The adversary destroyed everything he had. And yet, you know what it was all for? Well, he's not finished with him yet. And then finally Satan put his hand on Job's body. And he covered him with sores, with cancerous sores from the top of his head to the sole of his feet. And he sat down in the dust. You remember these friends, so-called, came along to visit him, and they sat down with him, and for 7 days nobody said anything. How do you like that? For a council of war. Nobody said a word. They were so amazed at his grief and at the sad plight that he was in. Just a running mass of obnoxious sores. And his whole world was completely disintegrated around him. And you think you've got troubles. You think you've got troubles. What was it all for? Probation, my friends. What do you mean by probation? Just to see how Job would react. That's all. That's all. Why? Well, because God and Satan had an argument. They had a discussion.
And the Lord said to Satan one day, have you seen the way Job lives? Have you seen the way he walks? Have you seen the way he conducts his business? Have you seen that he's my servant in your kingdom? And he serves me? And he hates evil? And he does that which is right? And Satan said, ha ha, let me touch his money and I'll show you what kind of a servant you've got. Let me touch what he's got and I'll show you. That's what happened. The Lord said, all right, but don't touch him. I'll show you how he'll react. And how did he react? He said, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. When Satan comes back again, the Lord said, Satan, have you looked at my servant Job? You incited me against him. I gave you permission. You told me I had a hedge around him and you couldn't get in, so I let you in. And you said that he cursed me to my face. Did he? How did he react? And Satan says, ha ha. Yeah, so, money. Yeah, so, family. Let me touch him and I'll show you how he'll react. And God said, all right, let's spare his life. So Satan gives him his boils from head to foot. You thought it came from a chemical imbalance in his metabolism, didn't you? You thought he ate some bad spinach or something. No. He got this loathsome situation from the hand of the devil, my friends. And what did he say? He said, although he slays me, yet will I trust him. He attributes it all to God. He didn't know the argument was going on. He didn't know the Lord and Satan had an altercation up there. He didn't know that they had a discussion and a dispute about how he would react. He took it all from God. Yeah, but you can be too simplistic in these things, can't you? You can be just far too simplistic. You can say everything happened because the Lord allowed it. Well, when your experience goes beyond that of Job's, then you'll be authorized not to say the Lord allowed it. Okay? And it was all to see how he'd react. And then his wife came along and she took a look at him and she said, are you still going to hang on to your integrity? Why don't you curse God and die? Or bless God and die, whatever you want. Depending on which translation you read. Why don't you just pack it in? Why don't you forget it? And that was the worst test of all, wasn't it? And he said, his wife, you're just talking like one of the foolish women talk. If God has given and if the Lord has taken, if he's pleased to let this happen to me, then blessed be the name of the Lord. Now look at that whole thing happened just to see how Job would react, and that's all. And it was a contention between God and Satan. Could something happen in our lives like that as a test just to see how we would react? If so, how would we react? Then, that's probation. Then there's another reason why one can suffer, as we read here, according to the will of God. And let me call this prevention. Prevention. And you know probably, it'll come to your mind, the case that I'm thinking of. I'm thinking now of the great apostle Paul. You remember what happened to Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, well, chapter 11, he tells us how much he suffered and all the afflictions that he went through. And in chapter 12, he tells us how one day he had an experience. He was raptured to heaven. He was caught up. He was snatched away. He said, I don't know whether I was in the body or the body, I can't tell you. Sometimes when I look at a person in the casket like we did Wally today, you look at him and you say, you just believe he was there. You'd almost think he was there. But you know he's not there. Well, how does he feel when he's up there? Well, Paul said, I couldn't tell you if I was in the body or out of the body. I don't know. I had the same feelings. I saw, I heard, I reacted. So I don't even know if I was in the body or not. He was caught away up to the third heaven and into paradise. And when he comes back down here to carry on his work, he tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that he got a messenger sent to him, and it was from Satan. And he calls it a thorn in the flesh, and I don't know what it was. You may know, you can speculate. There's all kinds of speculations. That's what it was. I heard one time. Oh, I better not tell you. And some people have given all kinds of answers. It just came to me right then. As to what this was, what happened to the Apostle Paul? Now you're not going to hear anything more I say, thinking what I was going to tell you. Well, I'm not going to tell you anyway. He said, I got a messenger from Satan, I got a thorn in the flesh. So I know that it was something in his body, something that molested him, something that bothered him, something that inflicted discomfort upon him, so much so that he said, I asked the Lord 3 times to take it away from me, and he said, no. Where did it come from? Satan. From Satan in his flesh? Yes. Well, why? He said, lest I should be exalted above measure. You see, I heard things that it isn't possible for a man to talk about. I saw things that nobody on earth has seen. And that naturally would tend to elevate me above everybody else. So in order to prevent me getting some high ideas about myself, I got this messenger from Satan, and it buffeted me. That means it just threw him around. Dreadfully distressing this was. Why? So he wouldn't get stuck up. So he wouldn't get proud. And you and I haven't had anything like that, have we? I mean, getting caught up into paradise. And yet we can get proud, can't we? Oh, can't we, Lord? Right? Here is suffering according to the will of God as prevention. It's to prevent something worse happening. And you might think if you had that messenger of Satan in your flesh, you possibly would think that there couldn't be anything worse than that. I know if the Apostle Paul, after he'd been beaten with rods and thrown into prison and shipwrecked and starved and betrayed by false brethren, and took it all gladly from the Lord, if now he is so distressed by this thorn in the flesh that he prays 3 times to have it taken away from him, I know it was something very acute. But he said, I realized afterwards it was necessary as a prevention to save me from being exalted above measure or lifted up with pride. Here's another one, correction. And you might know, I think you will, that I'm talking now about one of the apostles again. Briefly, what happened to somebody in order to correct a situation that existed in that individual? And again, we're going to go to the archenemy. Who, Peter tells us in the 5th chapter of his 1st epistle here, is your adversary. He's talking to Christians, and he says, your adversary, the devil. All right, who was it? It was Peter himself. He ought to know, because he got dropped one time into the hands of the adversary. You remember, in Luke's Gospel, chapter 22, the last night of our Lord's life, the Lord said, when they said they believed and they were sure that he was the Son of God, Peter was so confident particularly, that now they had come to a settled conclusion as to who the Master really was. And they say, we believe and are sure. And then the Lord said, do you really believe? Do you know that you're all going to forsake me this night and flee? And Peter says, no. You got it wrong, Lord. You got it wrong. You know Thaddeus? Well, he likely would. You know Andrew? He's very quiet. He wouldn't stick up for anything. You know Matthew? Well, I wouldn't doubt that when he shut his books up that day, you called him to follow you. I wouldn't doubt at all. He didn't really close the accounts. He'll probably go back and be a tax gatherer. I wouldn't doubt any of these fellows here, Lord, would forsake you tonight. But I wouldn't. I wouldn't. They might, but I wouldn't. The Lord said, "Satan, Simon, Simon." Peter should have been alert when he said that. Simon, Simon, shouldn't he? Here's the old man still. Simon, he says, Satan has made a request for you tonight, that he might sift you as wheat. Simon, Satan has made a request for you all.
all of you tonight, including you.
See, Simon, Peter, he took himself apart. He said, well, they might, Lord, but I wouldn't. Okay? What's that? Self-confidence. And that is something, my friends, that we must of necessity have corrected in us. Self-confidence. How many times have you been absolutely sure you could handle a situation and the whole thing came down around your ears? You messed it up. And the Lord allowed that to happen in order that he might correct a deficiency, a flaw, a weakness in our personality. And we've all got weaknesses, by the way, in our personality, just in case you're wondering. Your weakness isn't mine, my weakness isn't yours, but we all have it. And some of us have a whole lot more of one kind than another, right? Some of us wouldn't stand up for anything, anytime, anywhere. And some of us would stand up for everything, all times, everywhere. Of course, they're both wrong positions to occupy, aren't they? We all have these deficiencies in our personality. You're nice and sweet and gentle, but you're probably hot-tempered. And, why go on and elaborate? You know, we have all these things. Peter says, now look, they might do it, I won't do it. The Lord says, Satan's made a request. Actually, I think the word's stronger than that. It's a demand to have you, and he's going to sift you as wheat. But Peter or Simon, I've prayed for you that your faith doesn't fail. And when you're restored, strengthen your brethren. Strengthen your brethren? How can you strengthen your brethren? By finding out your own weakness. Did you hear that one? How do you go and help somebody else? By having an experience of your own that proves that you've not only got feet of clay, like a man told me here in the hall here just the other day. He said, well, I told my wife, Dave's got feet of clay like everybody else. I said, did you tell her he's got a head of wood too? He said, no. He didn't go that far, but I think he kind of would like to have said it just at that point. I said it for him because I thought he'd agree with me, but he was at least polite enough not to agree. Now, this is true. And how do I go along to somebody else? As Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, how can you comfort somebody else unless you've had that experience yourself? Right? Of course. And that's what's happened to Peter. Peter's had the experience. He failed. He denied the Lord. He called down on himself oaths and curses. That's what it means, I think. So help me, if I know him, may I die before the cock crows 3 times. You know? That's the kind of a thing he said. He wasn't cursing the Lord's name for those and curses. He wasn't cursing the Lord. That's not the idea. He called down on himself cursing. If he really does know this man. And so he revealed the weakness and he was sifted. And he was suffering according to the will of the Lord. Why? To correct that deficiency in his personality. 2 more than I've done. That's 4, isn't it? That's 4?
Yeah.
Yeah? My mathematics isn't as bad as I thought it. Okay. Here's the second last one. Retribution. Retribution, or you can call it punishment if you will, and that's the one that we think of most often, but I didn't make it the last one because I don't want you to remember it as the last one because I know you'll remember it without any help from me. Yes, it is true that we suffer according to the will of God for our own deeds. Yes, it is true that the judgment of God demands that. Judgment must begin at the house of God. We read that here in 1 Peter 4. And if it begins at the house of God, then you know what's going to happen with the rest. So, there is such a thing as retribution. And the most outstanding case I know of that is Moses. When he was not allowed to go into the promised land because of his failure. And you know what the failure was? Numbers chapter 20. When he smote the rock 3 times, when the Lord told him to speak to the rock. And God blessed the people of Israel, even though his servant failed. And he told him, speak to the rock and I'll give you water. And Moses said, ho now, you rebels. And he smote the rock. Must we bring you forth water out of the rock? And out it came abundantly, because God is good and God is gracious. But Moses sinned against the law. And God charged him later with not sanctifying him in his heart. I think that hurt the Lord most of anything. And Moses, like Paul, prayed 3 times.
for the Lord to let him go into the promised land. Do you know what it's like to be working for 40 years to try and get an accomplishment, get something done? Do you know, after he's been leading these people through the wilderness and putting up with all their stubbornness, all their rebellion, their idolatry, and all their aggravating stubbornness and idiosyncrasy, do you know what it's like after all that then to say, because you did one thing wrong, you can't go into the land? And he asked the Lord three times, and finally God said, Moses, don't speak to him anymore about it. Please, don't speak to him anymore about it. You can't go in. That's retribution. That's suffering according to the will of God for a misdeed. Now, in closing, the last one, we have it right here, and I'm going to call it participation. Where was it we read? Verse 12, beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you, but rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings. That's participation. That's me feeling the same thing that the Lord felt when he was here. That's Paul saying in Philippians chapter 3, that I might know him, the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his sufferings. He says, look, my brethren, you're a partaker of Christ's sufferings. Rejoice. This is suffering according to the will of God. This is walking alongside the law. This is sharing the same thing that he experienced. And he said it should make you glad instead of you considering it some strange thing. To me, it is a moving thing to think that the Lord actually wants somebody to walk alongside him in the pathway that he walked when he was here. Should not a servant tread it still? If the master went that way, he wants us to share with him in even his sufferings. And that is perhaps the highest experience of all. I left it to last because I think it is the highest, and I've got the least time or none at all to talk about it. But it's fellowship, it's companionship with the Lord. It's having the sense of the nearness of his presence, because he's called us just to walk where he walked. Participate. Suffering according to the will of God. So we pray.